is Sharon, and I serve the village's education coordinator, and it's my pleasure to introduce and welcome Roy Hammerling. I absolutely love your title. Women of Wonder will show us the way. I could have a whole list of women that would go under there, right? Everybody saw it. He has picked three, and I think today is going to be Hildegard of Bingen. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Roy is professor of religion at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, where I live, so that's a good connection. So welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sharon. And thanks, Chuck and Peg, too. Thanks, Chuck and Peg. It's always fun to be here. The thing I always love about Holden is just getting into this space, and we were just talking about hearing the music of Hildegard, and it just kind of puts you in a certain space. Holden does that for me. It gets me here. That's what I love about Holden. But I also love getting to know the people, having these sorts of opportunities to talk and visit. And most important, I love the dress code. I don't have to wear a tie or anything like that. Speaking of,
there, is that on? Okay, that's a little better. Sorry about that. Well, when Sharon and I were started talking, and she said the theme was fear not, the Isaiah passage. Last year when I was here, on the 500th anniversary of Luther's 95 Theses, I did a lot of talking about Luther. And so I thought this time I wanted to do something with women. My background is that I'm a medievalist. I kind of got screwed up as a kid as reading Lewis and Tolkien, and always thought that I wanted to read what they were reading. And very interestingly enough, that took me on a long journey that eventually got me a PhD in medieval studies. And so I've been interested in medieval Christian spirituality, especially mysticism, Christian mystics. And when I was thinking about people who might show us the way to deal with fear and give us some courage in the modern world, I decided to try to juxtapose three women that are very different and just to see what came out of that. Sometimes by putting different people together, you have some insights and some vision of how things in the world might be better or why the way the world is the way it is. And so I thought of putting together a nun, an abbess, Hildegard of Bingen from the 12th century, alongside, she's from a noble family, we'll see that, probably one of the most educated women of the Middle Ages that we will come across, you would come across in your studies. And I wanted to juxtapose her with a peasant woman. Hildegard lives a long life. I wanted to juxtapose her with a peasant woman who is illiterate and who dies at the age of 19. And then I thought, let's bring it into the modern world, into the 20th century, by looking at Dorothy Day, who's a person who I've had some scholarly interest as well. I've been interested in all three of these women in a scholarly way, one way or another. And just to kind of see what comes out. And so I'm going to give away my outline right away, first of all. And my outline is to suggest, okay, if we're looking at this Isaiah passage, which is the theme, a couple verses that in Isaiah where you can find this theme, and we look at these three models, I wanted to ask the questions, what were their fears, first of all? If you look at these people's lives, what sorts of things come up regularly? And I found basically a few things that stuck out to me that came out in all three of these women. And they come out in different ways, but they're very similar. And their solutions to the problem are very different. And so maybe that is going to help us think about some of these things. So the first thing that came up with all of these women was that they all had tremendous personal doubts and shortcomings. There was something in their life that they had to overcome that was a difficulty, partially because of a society that they were living in, the context in which they lived, or some sort of reality which was a part of their lives. And so I want to talk in each of these talks. I'm going to talk tonight and then throughout the week on these women. Each night I'm going to have the same sort of pattern. So we'll first look at their personal shortcomings. Secondly, the other thing that was remarkable to me that just jumped out at me, and I was thinking of this with Gary's talk this morning as well, when he's reading this Hosea passage and talking about Hosea and the instability of the government and those sorts of things at the time. These women lived at a time of great internal world conflict, huge sorts of conflicts going on within their local governments, but on a grand world scale. And I started thinking, wow, that really fits with what we're doing, with our world, you know. Are we really any different than maybe these women? And maybe they can give us some insights. The other thing I found is that they all had a great deal of insecurity or uncertainty about the religious institutions and the values of those institutions of their day. And all three of these women challenged those. They challenge the governmental systems, and they challenge the institutional system of the church at that day. And so I thought, well, can we learn something from that, from their methods or how they did that? And then finally, one of the big fear that all of these women had was the idea of persisting despite the hopelessness they felt in their situation. And I thought, wow, that really fits for me today, how I sometimes feel about, you know, modern day politics and some of those sorts of things. And as I was pulling these sorts of things out, I thought, well, what in the end, how did they deal with those fears? And that's where I wanted to go each night. And their stories are wildly different. They're wildly different people, and yet I think there's something that draws them all together. So for me tonight, what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk about Hildegard of Bingen. Now, there's a lot of ways that I can talk about this. I had a colleague who said to me, so you're going to talk about Hildegard's theology? I said, yeah, I will talk about that a little bit. But I find it a lot more interesting if you talk about their spiritual journey, if you talk about their lives, their biographies, who were they, why did they act the way they did, what sorts of contexts they have. And so he says, oh yeah, that's a lot better. You know, you don't get bogged down in deep theological things and put them to sleep. He's a Ricoeur scholar, so he says he puts everybody to sleep. I have that tendency, feel free. I'm both a pastor and a teacher. I have a double somniac effect on everybody I talk to. So I tell that to my students, and they listen to me, unfortunately, too well. Let me just say a few things about Hildegard of Bingen's background and my own connection to her. I have a very personal connection to Hildegard. Hildegard was born, we don't know what day, the day that she, some people say is the 16th of September in 1098. And she was born in Bremersheim, Germany. Her mother was Mechthild of Merxheim on the Nach River. And that's the woman I'm connecting to. Hildebert of Bremersheim was her father. She was minor nobility, and she was, we have different accounts. Records say that there was 7 brothers and sisters in her family, but some of her own accounts suggest that she was the 10th child. And in the Middle Ages, what you would do often when you had 10 children is that 10th child was a tithe. And you gave that child to the monastery or the local church in some sort of way. And so Hildegard talks about this idea of her being a tithe. And so she was given to a monastery at a very, very early age, maybe as early as 6, probably no later than 8, but at a very early age. Now, why is this personal for me? Well, Hildegard's mother is from Merxheim. Merxheim is a part of Germany. I'm going to just kind of show you this little blue arrow here. There's this important monastery called Dizzy Bodenberg, which is where Hildegard goes into the monastery at a very young age as a little girl. And it's on the Na River. And the Na River, if you follow it, goes right up into the Rhine. And right where it meets the Rhine, where the Na meets the Rhine, she forms another monastery called Rupertsberg. And eventually, her final monastery will be in Eibingen. And that's why she's called Hildegard of Bingen. So what about Merxheim? Well, I took this picture of the Na River a couple weeks ago. I happened to be back visiting my relatives who live in Merxheim. My grandfather, and yes, he just does have one arm. He lost an arm during the war. My grandfather and my grandmother, who has a twinkle in her eye that I am sure is the twinkle that Hildegard of Bingen has. They were married for 70 years before they died in the late 80s. But they they kind of give me a sense of who Hildegard is, especially my grandmother. My grandmother is a remarkable herbalist. She was completely uneducated, but at the age of 12, became a midwife, delivered her first baby at the age of 12 because her mother was a midwife, and she was a midwife, and there was two babies being born, and she had to go deliver a baby. And so that sort of womanly spirit, delivering babies at the age of 12, that reminds me of Hildegard of Bingen, as does my aunt. And my aunt is still lives in Merrixheim. We were just visiting them, and we just did the trail. We just went to Dizzy Bodenberg. We just saw the monastery of Hildegard again for, I don't know, the how manyth time. I would travel to Germany regularly, and my grandparents lived in Merrixheim, in a town close there, Sobernheim, right by Dizzy Bodenberg in this very lush area where Hildegard is from. And my aunt and my grandmother are these people who know incredibly wise women, who we would be walking down a road and my aunt would pull up a thing and a weed off the side of the road and start picking the leaves and stuffing them in her purse. I said, "What's that for?" She says, "I got a little headache. That'll be good for that later." And the women in this area, the people in this area, are very, very connected to the land. There's a very deep spirituality to the land and to herbs and medicines and things like that that still exists. And I think it's partially because of Hildegard having been from this area and having grown up here. And we'll see why that develops in her. And a lot of my sources are coming from a small little book by a guy named Gottfried and Theodoric. Two monks who lived in the monastery at Dizzy Bodenberg and who wrote down her life. And interest in Hildegard started in the 1970s. I think there's two reasons for that. One, it was the 800th anniversary of her death, and also it was the feminist movement was starting to pick up in the 70s. And they were looking for voices that had been overlooked, and Hildegard's was one that had been overlooked by the vast majority of scholars. And so as a result, Hildegard started coming out into the forefront thanks to feminist scholarship and thanks to medieval scholars. And I'm glad to say that my particular area of scholarship in medieval studies was a forerunner in feminist studies and bringing people like Julian of Norwich and Hildegard of Bingen and a lot of these people to light that had really not been read or known much about for a long time. So let's go back to Hildegard. So Hildegard is about 8, let's say, and she goes, and this is a picture of her going into the monastery at Dizzy Bodenberg. It was what was later called a double monastery, which means there were both men and women at the monastery. It was a Benedictine monastery, which means that they were outside the cities. They were very rural in their places where they put themselves. And as opposed to like mendicants, monastic orders, which Luther was a part of, which were in cities, they had more of a different sort of charism that they went with. So she's a young girl. She's taken out into the country. She's taken to this hilltop on the top of a mountain above the Na River and the Glan, which come together, and there's this beautiful mountaintop there. And she is given to a woman named Jutta, who is also a mystic and a very important a woman who in the church of this early time. This is very deceiving because Jutta was only 6 years older than Hildegard at the time that she gets her. So think about that. If she's 8, Jutta is about 14. And Jutta is already seen as a woman of great spirituality. People are coming to her for advice. She is having visions. And she's raising Hildegard. She's teaching Hildegard, educating her, teaching her how to read, teaching her how to sing, teaching her how to weave, teaching her about art, teaching her about all sorts of things. And Hildegard is going to become one of the great scholars of the Middle Ages because of her training. Her father, Jutta's father, was a Benedictine anchorite. Now, if you know the stories of Julian of Norwich, you know that an anchorite is somebody that was put onto the side of a church in a little room, and they would stay in there throughout their lives, and that's called an anchorite. They anchored the world. They prayed for the world. They were people of wisdom and great insight, and What happens, Jutta's father had gone into, why, we don't really know. We don't know much about Jutta at all. Maybe her mother had died. He was a very spiritual man, decided to go to Dizzy Bodenberg. She goes there as well. She becomes an Ancherite, and Hildegard and she, at Hildegard, when she's about 14, become enclosed. They're on the side of the monastery. Eventually, the reputation of Dizzy Bodenberg becomes really, it's a very unusual name, right? Dizzy Bodenberg, I love saying it, but, and I used to go there as a kid, and we would go, my wife and I and our kids would go there. Dizzy Bode was a monk from Ireland who came down and re-established a monastery in this land, so in the 8th century, I believe it was 8th century. And so then this monastery grew up from there. And then a women's monastery grew up because of Jutta and Hildegard and their reputation there. Here's another picture of her, of Hildegard, being given to Jutta. This is a mural at the church in Eibingen that you can see if you go there. Again, the question of age is very interesting, but you can kind of see there's a hint at here that there's this enclosure, this little area that they went into for a while. Dizzy Bodenberg is a massive monastery, incredibly beautiful. This is a 19th century drawing of Dizzy Bodenberg. This is the old hospital or the hospice that was connected to the hospital in this area where a lot of people came. And this is the pictures of it today, still somewhat intact, where people would come for healing. And Hildegard herself will have this very important reputation as a healer, we will see. But one of the things that I want you to see and take away from these pictures of this is the spot where the old altar is that when you go there, it is incredibly green. It's a canopy of greenness. The ground is green, it's lush, it rains, anything grows, everything just pops up, and it's fantastically beautiful. The idea of greenness in Latin is viriditas. And that is one of Hildegard's key theological themes. She says the Holy Spirit is greenness. The Holy Spirit is life. The Holy Spirit teaches us about the goodness and beauty of everything. Now you can see how green it is, right? Just these are the ruins. They have added a maze there as well, and this is kind of in honor of Holden's maze. And you know, you can see my wife walking it there with our kids, and our son making it to the center. He was pretty proud of that at the time. And this is another picture I just took a few weeks ago of the vineyards that are around Dizzy Bodenberg. There's lots of wine. They made their own wine, and a lot of that was for medicinal purposes, but also for selling it so they could do things. And if you walk around, if you read German, you can say, we're the only ones that have Riesling, the Hildegard of Bingen Riesling, you can buy it here. You know, there's monasteries, there are wine sellers that sell the wine that comes from this Dizzy Bodenberg area. And when we went out to dinner one night, there was a salad plate called Hildegard of Bingen. You can eat fresh greens of Hildegard. It's fantastic, right? And this is my favorite picture I took while we were there. If you read German, you can see what that says. This guy is working in fields close to Hildegard's monastery. It says, Jesus drinks Riesling. I thought, I knew it. I knew that Jesus liked Riesling. I thought for sure. Okay, I digress. I need to get back to Hildegard. So we'll come back to these monks and these stories that we learn about. So I said, first of all, the first thing that I was interested in looking at was the personal doubts and shortcomings that created fear within Hildegard, and it's hard to kind of get into this, but if you read her writings, there is this thread that comes through it. She was gifted, she's got a lot of names. She was known as a prophet, a seer, the Sibyl of the Rhine, and if you know the Sibyls, they were the oracles, the women that were on Mount Delphi that would give the oracles to Socrates, who came, and Socrates, you know, wants to know what he should do with his life, and he asks, what should I do? And somebody had told him that he's the smartest man in the world, and this oracle tells him he doesn't know anything. And he goes, okay, that's it. I'm the smartest man in the world because I'm the only one who knows that I don't know anything, right? And so these oracles had these visions and things, and so Hildegard is often connected to this. And visions are, it's interesting, visions are the first personal doubt that she has about herself. In 1141, she had a vision of fire, as she calls it, and God said to her, write what you see and hear, but she was afraid. She had doubts. She didn't know whether these visions were, well, are they of God? Are they a making of my own mind? What are they? How do I deal with this? And they scared her. And she became ill. And she has a confessor, a guy named Volmer. You can see him in the picture here. He's peeking in. And she's having this thing, it looks like an octopus jumping on her head. It's meant to portray her having a vision. And this is a wax tablet that she's writing it down. And then Volmer is also writing her visions later on. When she finally, she becomes ill, and Volmer tells her, what are you doing? Have you done something to make God angry? She says, the only thing he told me to write, and I haven't done it. And so she says, Volmer says, write. And one of the things that she writes is really interesting. So she says, at the very moment when God fashioned me in the womb of my mother by giving me the breath of life, he infused a clairvoyance into my soul. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure she understands what that means, but she feels like at the very beginning of her life that there was something happening to her. She was having visions from a very, very early age. She notices, in my third year of life, I saw a great light that caused my soul to tremble. But because of my childhood, I could not express this clearly. Up until my 15th year, I saw much and I told a great deal to those who heard it and wondered. I also wondered and I concealed the visions as well as I could. So you can see that she has this doubt and about her gift. Now, one of the things that she does as later on, when she starts writing, she becomes healthy again, and she starts putting these visions down. She has somebody in the monastery draw the visions. She explains to them how they should look. And so we fortunately have these fabulous manuscripts with her visions, with pictures like this one. And this one's called The Radiant One. Notice that the Radiant One kind of flows right, and there's no head here. It just kind of flows right up into Christ, and the vision becomes a part of who Hildegard is. And then there's this person covered with eyes and the world represented it, and Christ in glory, who is also revealing these visions to Hildegard. So then she says, I see these things not with external eyes or hear them not with external ears. I see them only in my soul with my bodily eyes open. I never lose consciousness of the ecstasy. I am awake both night and day. The light I see is not restricted to the room. It is represented to me as a shade of the living light. In this light, I sometimes see another light. It's called the living light. When and how, I cannot say. And when I look at it, all sadness and anxiety are taken from me. I feel like a simple young girl, not an old woman. So these visions are a cause of great anxiety for her. Fortunately, at a young age, she meets Jutta. Jutta, who also has visions, helps her kind of negotiate this landscape, but she keeps this a secret until she's 42. And finally writes and finally gets well because of it. And then for the next 10 years, she's going to develop a manuscript called the Shivyas. Shivyas is a series of 26 visions. There's 35 illustrations. And it was written with the help of Volmer. And there's a woman that's really important in Hildegard's life called Richardis. And some people think that she was the artist that drew out the visions in the books. Here you can see both Volmer on the left and Richardis on the right. And Hildegard, again, having these visions. This fabulous manuscript of these, the original manuscript of this was lost during World War II. They took it to Dresden for safekeeping. And you remember what happened to Dresden. It was lost after the war, probably destroyed in the bombing. Very sad, but we had a copy of it. They had made copies, hand copies of the manuscript, so we have a very close facsimile of what those manuscripts were. So Hildegard has this amazing talent for art and for writing, And she uses that talent to deal with her fears. And notice that I find that really interesting. So she's these complex visions like this egg of the universe, which I find so beautiful, right? Or just a simple picture of what the heavens are like, the nine choirs of angels, which is the medieval cosmology where there were these nine things. If you've read C.S. Lewis's the science fiction trilogy, he plays on these nine choirs. Or the fantastic true trinity and unity. This is actually on the altarpiece at the church in Eibingen. If you go there to Germany, you can go there. The nuns are really sweet. They'll take you in a heartbeat. And then this whole vision of the Shivyas is intended to tell the whole story of the salvation history. So it talks about the Trinity. It talks about Christ's salvation. Here's a picture of death being bound and thrown into hell. It talks about the mystical body of the church. It talks about the end times. These interesting vision of falling stars and the day of great revelation. So she writes. She throws herself into this talent that she has. And I think that that's the way that she starts to deal with the fear. Notice that her fear and anxiety, first of all, is her questioning what is her relationship to God? What does her experience of the world say to her? How should she be? What type of person should she be? What sorts of things should she do? And so she starts doing what she cannot help herself but do. And that's right. And I'd ask you to think about what is the thing that you can't help yourself from doing, and does that help you deal with your anxieties and fears and struggles in this life? What is the thing that you can do? And that's what Hildegard did. But she needed encouragement. Thankfully, she had Vollmer, her confessor. Really sweet guy. Very compassionate guy. Now, Jutta, we are told, is very, very smart, a great visionary, a great spiritual person, but she was tended to be very harsh, very ascetic. And Hildegard moves away from that asceticism intentionally, I think, and is much more compassionate in some ways than Jutta was. But Vollmer eventually sends her visions to Pope Eugenius III, and he will share them with a great thinker by the name of Bernard of Clairvaux, if you know that name, and they will say that her visions are authentic. And she will go, wow, the church is, you know, giving me some support. But it was only because she started writing and getting things out there, and now people were coming to Dizzy Bodenberg and wanting to learn more. And that's where some more doubts and problems come in. Now, I just want to say a few things about the Shivyas. This has a remarkable influence on a number of people. Goethe knew it. He saw the original manuscript and said it was one of the most extraordinary manuscripts that he'd ever seen. Carl Jung said it helped him think about the idea of archetypes. And if you know Jung and archetypes, that's pretty central to his thinking. And many others who saw the illustrations and the narratives have been deeply, deeply influenced. I gave a talk in Moorhead. We had the St. John's Bible there, and I did talk about Hildegard's influence on the St. John's Bible, which was rather significant at that time. So she's had an incredible influence. Now, I'm going to take a quick breath. I should have said earlier, feel free to stop me at any time. My students know that if they can get me derailed, I will go wherever they want me to. You know, I would rather talk about what you're interested in than just necessarily sharing what I've been thinking about. So don't hesitate to stop me if you...
So the women of that time had the same rights in the monastery as the men. I'm surprised they taught her how to read and write.
Yeah, women were educated in the monasteries. And this is a very important point. One of the last points that I wanted to make before I moved to this point. So I'm glad you slowed me down here. So the women were educated. Jutta and Hildegard, because of their visions that are slowly, especially Jutta, we don't learn about Hildegard until later. But because of that, they draw a lot of women there. And so now that's a double monastery, men and women both at Dizzy Bodenberg. And then it's an educational center. It's a healing center. They were well known, like my grandmother and my aunts, who know the herbology of the area and all that sort of stuff. So they had to be educated. Hildegard could write in Latin. She was very sophisticated. We will see in a minute in some of her writing. I read her, and I find her really hard to read in Latin because her style is a little bit unusual. So there might be some elements of self-taughtness of that, her there. But no, they did educate. And Hildegard really becomes very well educated. We'll see why, I think. And she has certain other gifts as well. But no, women in monasteries were well educated. And there's evidence that especially noble families would send their daughters to the monastery at young ages, and the nuns would actually educate them. So that was one of the few places where you could get education. It was also one of the only places you had hospitals for especially lay people. And it was also one of the only places you go to worship. It's largely a rural culture, right? So you go to the monastery to worship. So monasteries were extremely important for that. But the vast majority of the culture is illiterate. So this is very sophisticated. And Hildegard comes from a minor noble family, so that's an in for her. And Richardus is clearly from noble family, so that's another question we're going to have to ask is, you know, this, what sorts of expectations are on there. So Jutta dies fairly young, and so Hildegard then is unanimously noted and picked up to be the abbess of the monastery. And she's at age about 38. And so she now gets in control of running the monastery at Dizzy Bodenberg, but immediately there is conflict. Once her writings aren't around yet, right? You know, I said she doesn't really start writing till she's about 42. She's 38. She's taking over the monastery. So she's kind of educating women and helping them to become good nuns and doctors, and we'll see in a minute with music and other things. This is a sculpture that I particularly like. It's at Eibingen Monastery, of Hildegard. And I like this because it shows kind of this sort of resolute face of a young woman, and kind of, she's seeing, you can see that she's seeing behind her eyes, but we'll talk more about that a little bit later. So we have this gigantic monastery, huge monastery that's set up. You can see the women's monastery is going to be built up over in this corner. And eventually they're going to have quite a few women. Hildegard is going to, at this point in her life, now she's got some notoriety a little bit later in her career. A lot of nuns are coming to her. The money is starting to flow into the monastery because it's becoming a famous pilgrimage spot. People are coming for advice from this this mystic who can help them with lots of ideas and thinking. And so the abbot by the name of Kuno in Dizzy Bodenberg asks her to become the prioress, and that means he would still be in control of her. She would be the abbess there. And she says no. And he refuses to let her go. She wants to go and build another monastery at Rupertsburg. And she becomes ill. And when Kuno comes to her, he says, well, why, you know, is there anything I can do? She says, yeah, let me go to Rupertsburg. Let me take my nuns. We will not be under your control. And he doesn't want to do it. So she runs off with 20 nuns because the Archbishop of Mainz, which is a town close by, in 1150 says, you can build the monastery. So they go off and they start their own monastery. This is gutsy stuff at this time. Just, you know, you want me to do this, but we're not doing that. We know we're your cash cow. We're not going to do that. We're going to start our own monastery. They go, they get absolutely no support. And there is reports of them nearly starving to death because of the hardship that she had. Just a little bit about Rupertsburg Monastery. It was originally an Augustinian canon house, and then later on, unfortunately in 1857, it was destroyed when they built a railroad, put it right through there. So unfortunately, you can't really see much of the monastery. They're starting to rebuild it a little bit now because it's popular. But this is the description of life at Rupertsburg, how Hildegard dealt with these women despite this incredible hardships. Here, there is a wonderful competition among virtue. They're competitive about being virtuous. I read that to my college students all the time. That's a competition we need, right? You know, find a way to do that instead of football or something. The mother Hildegard embraces her daughters with such love, and the daughters submit with such reverence that they busy themselves in their own rooms on work days by copying from books, producing liturgical garments or handicrafts. This cloister is not founded by an emperor or a bishop, but by poor, involved, weak women. The mother Hildegard is lavish in her love of all. Notice that line. It's not founded by anybody else. These are women controlling their own lives. And that was part of the way I think Hildegard dealt with the frustrations and fears of the church that she had at that time, of people wanting to control who she was. She gives counsel when requested, solves difficult questions which are put to her, writes books, instructs her sisters, puts a fresh heart into sinners. Well, that's a nice phrase, right? How do you do that? Put a fresh heart into sinners who come to her and is fully and entirely busy with everything. In spite of the burden of her age and sickness, she accomplishes much by the exercise of virtues. This was written towards the end of her life. So one of the things I said, you have these personal doubts and frustrations. So what do you do? The first thing that you do is you go to your talents. And the first talent she had was visions and writing. But suddenly she realized that she had a talent for healing. And Hildegard became the first woman doctor in Germany, or first associated woman doctor in Germany. In fact, one journal I was reading calls her the first scientist of Germany. Because what she started doing, despite the fact that she has a reputation for healing, she started working with herbs and medicines, and she wrote journals on science, medicine, botany, and natural history. And a number of them are now in English. You can see them in a variety of scholarly texts that you can find. But this is the one gift that I want to give to all my college students when I teach them, and I would love all of us to have this gift. I would like to cultivate it, a keen sense of observation. She was incredibly curious, incredibly bright, and when she learned about medicine, she wrote down what cured and helped people, and how you can read her books and see that she is a person who is kind of way ahead of her time on that. And then that brings me back to my Aunt Rosal and my grandmother and that sparkle in their eye, and makes me realize that she had this huge effect on these people in this area who have a tendency, especially the women who have a tendency to take care of their health issues this way. The other thing Hildegard did was she wanted music, which there was obviously chant, Gregorian chant, and other sorts of things that the monasteries had, but she wanted to develop her own sort of musical, artistic, another artistic side of her. Remember, she's really good with art, but now she's going to develop music. So she has 69 compositions, one of the largest collections of any medieval composer that we know the texts are from. And she uses her own text to create unique synergy with the music. You heard it a minute ago, right? We're right in the middle of it. It's a little bit of instrumentation. I was struck by Chuck and Peg. We were talking, and they were saying, you put that music on before you start painting sometimes, because it puts you into this very meditative place. A friend of mine is a medieval musicologist, and when we were at Notre Dame, my wife Peggy and I helped perform the Ordo Virtutum. One of the pieces that she wrote was the first morality play ever written, and it was the first musical ever made. And it was basically, it's a story about a soul who is fought over by 17 virtues, like humility, faith, love, joy, peace, those sorts of things, and the devil. And the devil comes into the story, and he can only speak. Everybody else sings, but the devil speaks. The devil can't sing because that's harmonious. And the devil can never bring harmony, because the devil only brings discord. So the devil comes in shouting. We think that Volmer probably was the only male in these plays, and he had all these women singing. And then you have this sort of conflict between, it's like an intellectual conflict, although it's done in singing. The virtues say you should be humble, and the devil says, why do that? You don't get ahead with that sort of thing, right? And so they go back and forth. Eventually, the soul agrees with the virtues, and she goes to heaven. And fantastically beautiful music, but remarkably influential, right? Morality plays, lots of morality plays develop later. And we think that the Ordo Virtutum probably was done at the when a woman was taking her final vows and coming into the monastery, and you put on this play. It would be incredibly powerful, it would be incredibly beautiful also. She has wonderful music. If you go to Germany, I recommend that you go to Rupertsburg, which is a fun little town on the Rhine, and you just go up to Bingen and see the monastery and go in for prayers. And if you know Hildegard's music, we walked in and, you know, they were singing, the nuns are still singing the same music from Hildegard from those days. Pretty remarkable. If you want to know just the Sequentia version has done all of her music. There's a box set. You can have every last piece of it. It's really, that's what's playing here. And Anonymous 4, we actually had Sequentia come to Concordia and teach us about, you know, why they chose Hildegard, and when they had to go into the manuscripts to actually figure out how to sing them. And one of the things my friend, who has his doctorate in musicology, said, he could not find any printed version of Hildegard's music that was accurate, because her music was so revolutionary, the people that were copying it thought, it can't be. And so they changed it. And so you really have to go back to the manuscripts. And there are some people that have now done some nice work with that. So the other thing that happens, now Hildegard gets this reputation. She's known throughout Europe. Her music is being performed in Paris, and people are being surprised. And people start writing to her. The emperors write to her. She writes to emperors. She's writing to popes. She's writing to Frederick Barbarossa, Redbeard, who goes on crusade. And he has a great deal of respect for her, and she usually just chews him out when in her letters, you know. She writes him unsolicited letters. She says, you know, she speaks out against him. And the issue often sometimes comes up as justice. You're not seeking justice as a ruler. You're seeking your own advantage. Daring to speak to him. And it doesn't get very far. We have the letters. We know them today. But who really knows about these letters? But she dares it anyway. She now has the reputation and the talents to deal with the fears of the world. They're going on crusade. There's this huge war between Muslims and Christians. Anything changing, right? You know, we still have these conflicts today that are still the same. And she's saying what we need to do is seek justice. And you can see this through her letters. And she's quite bold. She writes to him that Frederick could actually put his own popes into office because he was powerful enough to do that. And she would be quite upset with him. But she does have quite a few people who are really interested in her. Pope Anastasius IV will write to her back and forth. Eugenius, we already know. Elizabeth von Schönau, another famous mystic. If you go to Luther's castle, Wartburg Castle, there's a room just with Elizabeth that is illustrated in the room. So this goes back to some Luther issues. A German visionary mystic. She was living at the same time. Hildegard and she were writing back and forth. Abbot Suger, who was responsible for the Gothic revival in Paris, who at Saint-Denis Church has the first Gothic church in Europe, was writing to her and saw her as a person of great importance, as was Bernard of Clairvaux writing back letters and forth, back and forth. So she became a theologian. And to answer your question a little bit more, women are not really allowed to write in the Middle Ages, right? Their letters or whatever, they don't have any authority, and you certainly can't write about scriptural things. The thing that women could do, though, as visionaries, is they could write about their visions. And especially in Hildegard's case, it was because she was told that she had to. She was told that she needed to. If you know Julian Norwich, the anchorite, has these visions. She has these showings in England. And for the next 20 years, the only thing she can write about is her own visions. But her visions, Julian's and Hildegard's, are steeped in theology. They know Augustine. They are reading Bernard of Clairvaux. They are reading the great church fathers and mothers and all these authors that they can find. And they're bringing that in, but they can write because of their visions. That's their authority. And they find a way to use their authority amidst a very, very difficult time and able to get out their voices. One of the after she writes the Shivias, she writes a book on the moral life while they're at Rupertsburg, which we heard about a little bit already. She also writes a commentary on John's Gospel, really just basically the prologue to John's Gospel. Again, you can see these fantastic illustrations. Notice how Hildegard is always kind of sitting down here in the corner, watching and seeing how the visions are playing out, such as the cosmic spheres of humanity. You can see the Father, Son, and the Son is represented as fire, you know, his feet, and then the Spirit in the water, and then, of course, Hildegard down here. I mean, this is really remarkable stuff, and it's so much fun to be able to spend a lot of time talking about this with students. But one of the things that comes out in her visions that we see and that feminists have really recaptured and claimed is they say, well, notice the sort of spirituality that we're getting here. An emphasis on the cosmos, the emphasis on greenness, veritas, an emphasis on the life force of God and the universe. And notice that this is all the four seasons, right? The people are working through different seasons. Hildegard is, again, observing. You have the zodiac symbols running around the outside. Is there something else you notice, Peg?
Oh, no, I just was looking how the water, I mean, how all of those things are depicted.
Yeah. Yeah, it really, really quite remarkable. The idea of gold is gold in both in icons in Greek Orthodoxy, but also in some Western art. Gold doesn't tarnish, so gold is meant to be a representation of heaven. So that's why you often see saints in a gold background, because it's meant to show that they're in a heavenly place. All sorts of these sorts of images. Notice radical images with women, bringing women to the center of theological principles and ideas and including them in unique ways. And often, Hildegard particularly, always represented the virtues as women. Different women and different aspects of women's personalities and developed that. Unique sorts of wisdom is portrayed as a woman. Of course, this is a very biblical theme coming from the book of Proverbs, wisdom being Sophia being a woman. And often the characters or figures are androgynously portrayed. Divine love upon the wheel, a very unique color patterns and brilliant sorts of ideas, but also you see the sort of God figure here seems very female.
Well, question?
Yeah, please.
Is she still having people draw for her, or is now?
Yeah, she's having people draw for her. So she doesn't, as far as we know, she never draws anything. She seems to say that, but we think maybe Richardus is working on these things. So she's saying, okay, like in this one, she would say, on this, there's a written text that goes with each of these. So she'll write out the actual text and say, okay, now notice in the circle, well, the red means this, the white means that, the woman holding the Ten Commandments, the divine hand in the top is in a five-leaf lotus flower. She has this is all symbol. And this allows her to preach and teach in a way that she couldn't if she was just a normal woman, so to speak. Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, they worked well. Yeah, the story with Richardus is a really interesting one. Richardus and Hildegard become very, very close. And they're very dear to each other. There is a movie out on Hildegard's life. It's in German, but it has subtitles. It's not too long, and it's kind of nice, and this Richardus relationship is played out. Late in life, Richardus is pulled away by an abbot who wants her to become an abbess of another monastery. Hildegard is absolutely heartbroken, and Richardus dies shortly after she leaves. And Hildegard, I don't think, ever really got over that. But you're right, that was this, you know, they worked, we think it's Richardus, we don't know, she doesn't say, but it's pretty remarkable. These are, they're unique in the Middle Ages, as is Hildegard in many ways. Finally, because Hildegard gains this reputation, they ask her to go on preaching tours. She's in her 60s, very young at the time. Right? I mean, I'm 62, so. But she's in her 60s. And at that time in the manuscripts, it says they see her as towards the end of her career. And now she's going out and driving around preaching, helping with healing, taking healing medicines and doing these sorts of things around. And often she's going on horseback. And then some things happen. And there's a sense of Hildegard struggling all her life, all of her life struggling with political powers, with the church, and a few situations come up that become really interesting. One of them is the story of a man who is a friend of Hildegard's. He is excommunicated by the Pope because he refuses to go on crusade. The Pope basically says, you know, everybody, we're going to get everybody in this area, you're all going to go to crusade. If you don't, you're excommunicated. The man is excommunicated. And so after a while, the man kind of rethinks this, and he says, okay, well, I think I'll go on crusade. You know, maybe I should have listened to the Pope. But he becomes ill. And so he goes to Hildegard, and the man dies. And Hildegard puts him in her cemetery. Now, this is the cemetery at Rupertsburg. This is a drawing of that cemetery. And so you can see the cemetery over here. So she buries him here. And the Pope hears about this, and he says to Hildegard, dig him up. He's excommunicated. She said, you know, he had repented of that. He was planning on being involved in the Crusades. He was going to support you, and he became ill, and I just buried him. And so he was a man in good standing. The Pope says, dig him up. He's an excommunicate. You got to get rid of him. She said, this would be terrible for his family and for others. We're just going to leave him here. The Pope says, dig him up. And she says, no, we're going to leave him here. So the Pope says, sends an army. We're going to dig him up. Hildegard takes down all the tombstones. And she creates her own language. She has her own language, which is kind of a version of Latin. But notice the letters are like, who can read that? Her nuns could. And they put markings down so they knew who was there, but nobody else knew who was there. And so they put an interdict on the monastery, which means the monastery, the nuns, may not sing. Of course, singing is, right, central to what Hildegard does. They can't have communion. So she writes this letter. Anyone who imposes silence on the church in regard to the singing of God's praises when on earth, they commit a wrong by robbing God of the honor of the praise that belongs to him. Will have no association with the praise of the angels in heaven if they have not corrected that wrong by genuine repentance and humble satisfaction. For the most severe punishment will be passed on the prelates if they, as the apostle says, do not carry out their responsibilities with diligence. The Pope lifted the interdict. He could not get past Hildegard. There were other conflicts between her and others, but she was always fighting for issues of justice. She's not completely blameless. There's also stories of her being a little bit harsh on nuns and things like that. But nevertheless, I find that there's a pattern that seems to come out. There, she writes of a certain sense of hopelessness, but there's a fearlessness that she has. She's not afraid to talk to emperors, and she doesn't really care whether it gets, you know, whether this is spread broadly or not. She's going to do what she can do. And that seems to be the answer to the way she solved the issue of fear. You just have to do what you can do. And so despite the shortcomings, she used her talents to seek justice in a world of chaos. This world was chaotic. Crusades, popes, kings, church officials trying to control her and the women of her monastery. And she kept emphasizing, we just have to work in a very small community and be the people we want to be. And I think that's key. That idea that you have to work together in small groups of people in the midst of fear and difficulties that like we're facing in the world today. And seek to make you seek to make the government just again, and you seek to make the church loving again. Those seem to be two themes. And she helped others with the gifts of healing and her deep love for creation. Everything comes out through that. It's also, I think, partially because these nuns are so connected to the land. They're growing their own grapes, they're growing their own herbs, they're growing their own... this is the monastery at Bingen, or Eibingen, and you can see the grape vines right underneath it. And this is another picture in the fall. It's very picturesque. The monastery was rebuilt in the 19th century and expanded upon a little bit. Just to give you an idea, the inside of the church, this is just one of the side chapels. This is in the monastery. But I want to take you back just for a minute to the Na River, where I was standing with my wife a few weeks ago. And when we were walking over the bridge, this is the Na River and this is the bridge, I noticed this, there was this little emblem in the corner. And then I noticed we started following the emblem. And this is what it says. The Hildegard of Bingen Pilgrim Way. And there are these little paths all over around where my grandparents and my aunts and uncles live that point out where Hildegard's monastery is. You can walk this way or go walking that way. And this is one of the paths. And at the top of the hill, about 4 kilometers, you see those little towers to the right. That's Dizzy Bodenberg, where you can walk. And I took my students to Eibingen Monastery, and Sister Ancilla welcomed us and then took us around the monastery. Sister Ancilla was from California, and she had gone there many years ago to join the monastery, having read Hildegard's writings in the 1970s, and was very, very taken by her. And there's that statue I mentioned earlier, which I'm quite taken by. It was done in 1998. And there's all sorts of beautiful art and architecture in and around the area to remind people of Hildegard. I remember I told you that one church, this is the church in Eibingen, and there's that illustration at the front of the church, and the reliquary is off to the side, and a number of her relics are there. But it strikes me that I deliberately called this Woman of Wonder because Wonder Woman is pretty popular these days. And but I really do think that we do need more people like a Hildegard. This is a statue that's inside the church at Eibingen. Pope Benedict XVI, and you will remember that Benedict XVI is German, placed Hildegard on the saints' calendar in 2012. Does that mean, what was the issue there? We have to go back. Remember I said Pope Anastasius IV? In the Catholic Church, the process for becoming a saint was founded by Pope Anastasius IV at the time of Hildegard. And it actually was founded partially to deal with the problem of Hildegard of Bingen. What would they do with her? Is she a saint? At that time, they decided no. And it wasn't until 2012 that she was placed on the calendar and wasn't made a doctor of the church until also later in 2012 by Why was that? It was because Hildegard stood up against emperors and particularly popes and asked them for justice and asked them for compassion. And that was not considered saintly. The other question is the pope, the process that Anastasius developed said that every saint has to have two miracles. One miracle while they were alive, at least. It has to be verifiable. And another miracle after they've died, that somebody's prayed to them and then a miracle has happened. And that process is still intact in the Catholic Church. And so the other part of that process is that local people would say, well, we think Hildegard's a saint. And the Pope would say, okay, well, what's your evidence? And they would say, well, she healed people. But the question was, what kind of healing was her process? Right? She's a doctor. She's using medicine. She's not using any sort of miraculous sort of form to heal people. So that wasn't considered good enough. In the Catholic Church, Padre Pio recently is in the process of becoming a saint. And so what you do is you set up an advocate, and you know this term, devil's advocate. Devil's advocate in the papacy to decide, they bring it like a court case and say this person should or this shouldn't be a saint. And the devil's advocate argues against it. And in Padre Pio's case, one of the miracles that they brought forward was that there was a child that had been born blind at birth. And the parents had prayed to Padre Pio and had visited him. He'd laid his hands on the child, and shortly thereafter, the child regained 70% of his sight. And the Catholic Church said, well, that's not a miracle, right? If it was a miracle, it'd be 100%. So 70% is not quite good enough. So they have a process, right? They're making these decisions. They have to be verifiable. There's certain standards, and especially in modern medical technology and those sorts of things. But Hildegard was set to the side until feminist scholars started picking her up and started bringing her back to the forefront. And now her popularity has made even a pope take notice, right? Benedict XVI, at least to acknowledge that she should be on the saint's calendar, although she hasn't gone through the official saint's route. She has a lot of sayings, and I would love to quote a lot more, but just this one is particularly a little parable that she has. She said, there once was a king sitting on his throne. It pleased the king to raise a small feather from the ground, and he commanded it to fly, and the feather flew, not because of anything itself, but because of the air, because the air bore it along, thus I am a feather on the breath of God. This sort of self-image that Hildegard develops in the midst of her own sort of personal doubts about vision, this sort of her constant battles with church officials and political officials, one of the things that some feminist scholars have struggled with is that she's very self-deprecating. She says she often refers to herself as a lowly, poor, uneducated woman, which is not really true. She came from a wealthy family. She's very well educated. But nevertheless, she sees herself that way. She sees herself as this sort of breath of God, this sort of breath, this feather that's pushed along by the breath of God. And I think that gave her the courage to be who she was. In part that she was able to simply stand up and speak out against the forces of the day, just using her talents, just being herself. And so to kind of summarize that a little bit, we talked about the fears. And so how do they not fear? You use talents, gifts, and a passion to seek a compassionate justice in the world. That's what she does. When I talk with my students, and I'm at Concordia, and we're trying to figure out, they're trying to figure out what they want to do with their lives, I've realized that I can't help them say this is the right way or that's the right way. I've had incredibly talented and gifted students give up their talent and gift for a passion. And that's okay. People who are incredibly bright, let's say in biology, and should be doctors, go off and wind up doing some other sort of work. And the other way is also true. People, some people just use their talents. I haven't quite figured out that formula, but somewhere in that pattern, I think, is the end goal is the issue. How do you live a life so that when you come to write your obituary, it sounds like it was worth it, right? And I tell my students, that doesn't start when you get out of college. It starts right now. If you don't start this right now, you're never going to start it, right? That the word that was spoken this morning about starting the race, right? You start now. You start in whatever way, but it's always seeking compassionate justice in the political world, seeking justice for everyone, Hildegard, even for excommunicated people, for outcasts. And loving God, neighbor, and also deeply rooted in creation and the love of the world that the God has created. And then I think this last thing I think is really important. How do they deal with persisting despite hopelessness? They have to fight the long defeat. What do I mean by that? J.R.R. Tolkien said that the overall thesis of his novel, The Lord of the Rings, was to fight the long defeat. My favorite theologian, Gandalf, kind of gives us a hint to this, right? Some believe that it is only great power that can hold evil in check, but that is not what I have found. I have found that it is small everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay, small acts of kindness and love. So the thesis of The Lord of the Rings, and I think the thesis of maybe Hildegard's life, is that you have this small community of people. You work together to promote virtues. You compete with virtue to make your world, the place that you're at, a better place. And from there, you change the world. That was Benedict's idea when he founded Benedictine monasticism. He said, I have to remove myself from Rome. I have to remove myself from the temptations of the world. I have to leave the world in order to save the world. Holden reminds me of that, right? You come here to be reminded of what's really important. And we go back to the world and you find those people that help you with those small acts of love and kindness. And that's where it starts. Love of creation, love of neighbor, love of God. And you find your way in the world. Or as Dorothy Zala says, you live in a world, live in the world as if the world had already been liberated. That's how you live. That's how you defeat hopelessness. And if you can't feed 100 people, then you just feed one, said Mother Teresa. And that brings us back to Hildegard. And I think that's the way she was able to kind of do it. I'm not sure we think about it quite in those sorts of terms. It's just finding that small group of people. It's finding that small way. It's finding that talent, that passion, those things that you have. It will make a difference. But as Tolkien said, it's the long defeat. It's not whether we are going to win this battle. It is how we decide to fight it. That's what matters for Tolkien and for, I think, Hildegard of Bingen. You can't change the world, but you can choose how you live in it. You can choose how you make a difference in it. And you can't do it on a grand scale. Some people can. I think a guy like Gary Mesa does it on a scale that I don't even understand. But I'm grateful for people like him. But I think for me and for us, a lot of us, we have to find ways just to do it in small little places. And Hildegard, I think, gave us some examples. Now, she's really unusual, right? Talented, bright, smart, writing music, writing, you know, doing everything. But you have those talents too, you know? Where are they? What are they? What would you like to do with them? So we have a few minutes. Any thoughts or questions or observations?
Well, the thing that I found interesting is I'm a nurse practitioner, and I've heard a nationally acclaimed speaker in natural medicine. She's also an MD, and she talks about how the German natural medicine database is the authority. Apparently. So yeah. I'm thinking, is this?
Oh, that's a direct result of Hildegard. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. She started it. You can go, If you go to close to Rupertsberg on the Rhine, where the Rhine and the Na come together, there are these little kiosks, you know, and they talk about German history, and one of them is Hildegard's influence on modern medicine. And we're kind of, this is in the middle of nowhere. What is that about? But they're trying to promote their culture and tourism and things. And it's interesting that these pilgrim ways have popped up. And a lot of people are flowing to Dizzy Bodenberg to see. But I think you go there, you just realize it's kind of like a holding place. It's one of those places that's kind of where time becomes thick, right? You kind of become present to the moment. And it's a thin place where the place that you're at is feels like it's a thin veil between heaven or the way life should be and where you're at, right? And those places, we need to find them, you know. That's why Holden's important. And we need to find them in our local communities, and you can do that with working with individuals. But you're right, that goes all the way back to Hildegard.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that she was named the Doctor of the Church.
The Catholic Church has designations for certain people that they want to lift up. Like Augustine is one of the key theologians of the early church. The women, it's interesting, there's only a few women that have been designated doctors of the church. All of them have been mystics. Teresa of Avila is one.
So it's like an academic doctorate type?
Yeah, like this person is worthy of study. Yeah, but they haven't picked very many of them. There's a few people that they lift up as what they call, they just give them this designation and say, this is somebody worth studying, this is somebody worth knowing. But it's interesting that women, one of my areas of expertise and what I write in is the history of the interpretation of the Lord's Prayer. I'm interested in spirituality and prayer, and I thought, well, if I look at how people interpreted the Lord's Prayer, I thought I could learn about different cultures at different times and use a kind of a standard thing. One of the hard things I've found is it's almost impossible to find any women writers. Hildegard has a commentary on the Lord's Prayer, but it's in a letter to an abbot who asked her would you tell me what you think of the Lord's Prayer? So she's writing in response to somebody who wants that information. But otherwise, she couldn't really do that sort of commentary. She can only write about her visions, or she can write about those things with that sort of authority. Teresa of Avila is another one who writes about the Lord's Prayer. And it's interesting, there's this sort of connection to some of them. But that's what that's about. It's an interesting issue, yeah. Other thoughts or observations? Oh. Well, yeah, Hildegard is one of those people. I love talking about her. I love any time I can talk to people in a room, because she's so remarkable. And what I want to set up next time, I mean, Joan of Arc could not be more different, except that the only thing that they have in common are these visions. And we'll have to talk about that. Joan is a completely different person. But I found the same pattern in Joan, and it'll be interesting to see. But it's a different, there's Joan's a lot more tragic. We'll have to talk about a little bit about that. But that'll be next. And then Dorothy Day is just Dorothy Day. She's so much fun to talk about. We'll all enjoy spending some time with all of you on that. But. So, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I appreciate it.